Hello, and welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie. My name is Marie Westaver.
And I'm Mike Giuliano.
And we both teach film here at Howard Community College. Today we're going to talk about two movies that are currently in the theater. One is Captain Marvel, and the second is Madea Family Funeral.
She's had her family reunions already. Yes. Now it's time for the funeral.
And since it's the last time Tyler Perry is going to do Madea, you know,
we'll talk about that. Never say never.
Well, officially, it's supposed to be the last Madea movie.
Yes.
Okay. You look like you have things to say about that.
Well, we should probably start with Captain Marvel, don't you think?
Okay.
Because, first of all, it got off to a terrific start. I mean, the weekend it opened, and we're talking now, you know, just after that. But, you know, $153 million, it's one of the top grossing. And even though I'm always, like, really highbrow and snotty and say, well, box office, you know, it is important. You can't ignore it. And there are correlations between that and so many aspects of filmmaking. But anyway, long and short of it, it had this terrific opening and, in effect, announced that, you know, it's not exactly news at this point that you can have female superheroes, but the fact that they're bankable. It reminds me of the discussions we were having a year ago about Black Panther. Take a film with an African-American protagonist in the superhero costume, and yeah, it went over well with critics and the public, but in terms of how incredibly well it went over. And, you know, in Hollywood, well, I know they pride themselves on being politically correct and on the right side, meaning the left side of issues. I got to say, the bottom line there is the bottom line financially. And when a movie does that well commercially, it makes it all the easier to say, well, yes, we want to have more black people in superhero movies. Yes, we want more women putting on superhero outfits. It's so much easier to say it at that point when you know that you know, and you know, joking aside here, if you're the producer, if you're an investor, you're putting tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars into a film. You don't want to feel like you're morally justified but totally broke at the end of that. So better to make money.
Speaking of costumes, though, I will like to get a shout out there because I was really appreciated the fact that Captain Marvel got to wear some clothes, you know, compared to Wonder Woman.
Wonder Woman had a minimal outfit.
That's, yes, minimal.
And this is where feminists, and can I speak as a feminist?
Why not?
This is where feminists themselves are split on an issue like this. Because when you talk about female empowerment and what it means to anchor a film that way, yeah, that's a very important discussion. In terms of wardrobe, the fact that, of course, you know, look at presidential candidates, that, you know, the women's outfits are always going to be commented on more than the men's. I mean, how much can you say about a guy in a dark suit with a red tie?
Mm-hmm. You know, can argue about, well, he shouldn't have worn that flag pin, or why isn't he wearing that flag
pin? But with the women, it'd be endlessly analyzed, and that's a whole separate subject for discussion, perhaps. But in this case, was the superheroes. In Wonder Woman, the fact that she was a Wonder Woman, that you know, she's certainly been working out at the gym. She's in great shape and has a rather minimal costume there. But where the feminists get split is, well, what signals is that sending? Is it sending a signal of self-assertion that you're powerful, you're strong, you're beautiful, you wear whatever you want, you can wear the colors of your country or whatever you prefer there and make a strong impression? Or is it reverting to older gender stereotypes and expectations that, you know, that in effect, when she appears on the screen like that, are many viewers thinking about her personality or thinking about other things? And so it is kind of touchy subject, isn't it? As to what would be an appropriate outfit for someone like that. But to tie it into the present film, she's more fully costumed in Captain Marvel. And I wasn't in the wardrobe department as they decided all these things, but I did notice that. I thought, actually, however you take her as a character, you don't feel like she's just entered a beauty pageant, right? And I think that's an important distinction.
Well, one of the things that came out in the movie Professor Marston and the Wonder Women is that the outfit for Wonder Woman, the cartoon character, the comic book character, was chosen from, you know, his bank of fetish wear.
Yes. In fact, the guy who created her, he really had a serious fetish. I guess that's redundant because every fetish is serious if you're the one who has it, right? And actually, when you look at his artwork and his mm-hmm. his predilections, I love the word predilections. When you look at his predilections, he was deeply into bondage.
Yes.
And so that her outfits reflected that. And, you know, like joking aside here, when that comic strip started in the early 40s and into the 50s, it was controversial at times because because she was always getting tied up.
Uh-huh.
We all get tied up in complicated situations. She was literally getting tied up. And you could just see what were really bondage scenes. And this is where in Congress, when they had in the early 50s, particularly when they were investigating comic books and how those were corrupting American youth,
mm-hmm.
Strips like that, comic strips like that, were actually, you know, it's funny to talk about now, but like in congressional committees where mm-hmm. they would actually hold up the comic books and look at her here. She's all tied up and somebody's got a whip and this and that. Now, you know, that for them was a big turnoff in terms of public morality, but I think it probably sold a lot of comic books.
Well, maybe it was like a feigned outrage just to, you know, sell some comic
books.
We
love feigned outrage.
We do. In
our society, with celebrities, we love to build them up and then to tear them down.
And then have a comeback story.
Then the comeback story. We are simultaneously prurient and puritanical. And it's been that way probably since the Puritans, but we've always enjoyed that, and you see it at kind of mega speed oftentimes with Hollywood celebrities as to when they're being praised and when they're being blamed, and then after they're blamed, you're right, then you have your comeback, and we all love forgiveness and redemption, so then you can come back from that. But back to the costumes, how did you feel about the costuming in Captain Marvel?
I liked it because it made her look strong rather than, you know, like some, you know, just a sex object.
Yeah, and she needs to be strong in the sense of what I call fighter pilot
mm-hmm.
strong. And, you know, I love the fact that because it is such a nostalgic film, and at this point we're nostalgic for the 90s, right?
And I loved that aspect of it, by the way. All the 90s stuff I thought was great. The lunchboxes.
But specifically the Blockbuster Video reference where mm-hmm. when she goes into the store, at that point there would not have been Hollywood feature films with female superheroes, which would have been funny if she could pick up a box and there's
yes.
a similar character. But no, instead she picks up the VHS for the right stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I mention that does tie into your comments about costuming, namely, and job description, namely that, you know, for a fighter pilot, those guys, and they were guys, had the right stuff. She now, as she picks up that box, she's got the right stuff. And you realize how, you know, when she's flying the not-so-friendly skies there, that she's got the strength. And she has a costume that's not distracting. You know, I mean, certainly, you know, she's a forceful, beautiful person. I'm not saying anything to the contrary, but the fact that you don't get fixated on that, you don't feel like it's a beauty contest.
Yeah, you don't have to have that scene where Wonder Woman's trying on all these clothes going, you know, how does anybody fight in this?
Well, I used to always wonder about that, too. Like, you know, can you even move in some of those outfits? Or won't they rip?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like embarrassing rips?
Yes.
Which would take it from PG-13 to R probably pretty quickly.
Yeah, you don't want a wardrobe malfunction, even in a comic book.
But, you know, you also get that sense of women who are suitably dressed for the job here
mm-hmm.
with her sidekick, that pilot, who's got the wonderfully clever name of Maria Rambeau. And she spells it R-A-M-B-E-A-U, but it's pronounced Rambo.
Mm-hmm.
So again, when you think about something as macho, as testosterone-driven as Stallone's Rambo, here you have Rambo, but it's feminized to the extent that it's given the French
mm-hmm.
treatment. But the fact that, you know, you can be a female Rambo, a warrior like this, and do your job, and meantime not have on an outfit that's borderline silly.
And then, of course, to have a cat named Goose to remind us all of Top Gun.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah.
And I love the cat.
Well, you know, find a person who doesn't love a cat, you know?
I mean, in terms of cat movies, this is an excellent cat movie.
Well, reason enough to see it.
But
actually, the cat really does have its moments. And even though I'm usually averse to like overly cute cat cards and
uh-huh.
movies and stuff, I got to say, the cat did get to me, yes.
Yes.
It was a very cute cat.
Very cute cat.
Speaking of which, stick around for the end credits on it because mm-hmm. you'll want to see the cat there. And I won't have any spoilers otherwise, but the cat appears late in the
film.
Yeah,
and it's a great final image.
It is. You have to sit through like 10 minutes of credits, and
yes.
that's now the torture session of you find out who drove the honey wagon and who just particularly with all the special effects.
The
I mean, that's like that credit roll is like, you know, hundreds of names
mm-hmm.
there. And I always look at it just in terms of demographic mix, like every person in India had a job on this film. You know, I kind of laugh about it because you look at the, like where they shop it out. Uh-huh. And they do. A lot of the special effects stuff gets shopped out to India or China or something. You start reading the names. It's not all Skywalker, it's not all George Lucas's stuff. They shop it out elsewhere. And I think it's great. Film really is an international medium now. You see it in those end credits oftentimes. And those are millions of dollars that are being spent on that, tens of millions of dollars.
One thing I thought was really very well done was the whole 90s thing, because you forget, it really isn't that long ago. But they're using like top technology of the time, which would have been, you know, jacking into physical phone booths and making these ridiculously long distance phone calls, and the you know, the references to the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air being on TV, and the nobody had a phone on them.
Well, the American obsession with nostalgia, I mean, you can make a case that really in Hollywood in the early 70s we suddenly became nostalgic for the 50s. You know, you start to get pictures looking back at 50s culture. And of course, the nature of nostalgia is it has that warm glow. It doesn't always correspond to what life was actually like, but it's the way we like to think it was, what we prefer. But in any event, not to go on that sideline, but simply that in the decades since then, that window has been shrinking in the sense that almost no sooner than a decade ends, then people start getting nostalgic. So in terms of the nostalgia for the 90s, there's a generational consideration here. Those of us who are already adults, I'll just safely say mm-hmm. we were adults in the 90s, we would say, well, that wasn't so long ago. But for somebody mm-hmm. who was a kid or a teenager in the 90s, those were the formative experiences. And now they are like, you know, 20 years further into their lives. And it does seem like, wow, that was the world of my childhood. And then so everything, and as you mentioned, you know, whether it's a lunchbox or a Blockbuster video, and also the fact that, you know, there are things that we take as constants in American life that movies like this remind us or not. I mean, who would have thunk it? Who would have thought in the mid-90s that kind of video store, which was everywhere in the American landscape, that it would go away? And it almost has completely gone away since then for obvious reasons. And do you know there's only one Blockbuster store left in the United States? It's in Oregon. And it's in a very small town. It has thousands of members, some of whom are people who actually live in the town, where I apparently, you know, they're not as wired or as connected as other people in the country. That's partly it. But also, tourists just to that part of the state will make a deliberate trip to go there because they want that nostalgic trip, and they'll actually go to that store. But that's weird, isn't it? I mean, the same way there's only one Howard Johnson's left in the United States, there's one Blockbuster. But the fact that we can't get enough, and I plead guilty too, we can't get enough of that kind of nostalgia, that adds rather a real level of interest to a film like this one. Because you wouldn't need mm-hmm. it, strictly speaking, right? You could have a contemporary
right.
setting.
Yeah, you can set it any time.
But these references, I think, really are enjoyable on their own.
And I think when they have to stop and wait for things to load, I think it's hilarious. Because they're obviously, you know, like I said, they're using the top technology of the day, but it's inadequate.
Well, people back then were just so primitive, you know. they didn't have all the sophistication.
You didn't have your
all.
Own phone, unless you have one in a bag.
Well, exactly. And I actually, you know, I love watching old movies now because it's a reminder of things like telephone booths, how much those meant in movies back in the day. And like, think about a spy thriller or any kind of adventure story where back in the day, and this is like think of a, you know, like a Bruce Willis Die Hard kind of film where, you know, back in the day with the original installments there, you had to run and try to find a payphone.
Right.
Right. And that became part of the intrigue. Can you find a phone? And that, we watch it now thinking, what's this dude's problem? I mean, why doesn't he just take out his phone and, you know, call for help? And so technology really does affect narrative construction, among other things. And so a film like this one, of course, is very self-aware. So it has a lot of fun with all mm-hmm. that.
Great Stan Lee cameos, too. So, what did you have more you wanted to say about Captain Marvel?
I was really thinking about it in terms of how this kind of a film did incredibly well at the box office. And by way of the business model in Hollywood, as this particular Captain Marvel film gives us the origin story, it's already setting us up for sequels and additional treatment. For instance, if you keep watching the film, you are told, and you might find this either welcoming or frightening, you're told, quote, Captain Marvel will return in Avengers Endgame.
Mm-hmm.
So as many of you folks are listening to this program, you know, indeed, you know, a few weeks will have gone by, and then there's Captain Marvel again. And it's that omnivorous, inexorable, can't escape from it nature of franchise filmmaking that you're always going to have a sequel. You're always going to have this character appear again. And I'm not a particularly huge superhero movie fan, so I kind of grimace a bit sometimes thinking, you know, can I get away from this? Isn't there some obscure art house film I could see instead? But speaking of segues, actually, from Captain Marvel to Madea, the Madea franchise has not exactly been averse to sequels.
No, not at all. I guess the first one was Diary of a Mad Black Woman?
Yeah, back in 2005, Tyler Perry released Diary of a Mad Black Woman. And the current film we're talking about, A Madea Family Funeral, did extremely well at the box office, and he's got a real following. And he announced this that it's the 11th in the series, specifically in the Madea series. He's actually done some films outside of that. My math is he's done around 16 films total. 11 of them would be Madea, 16 give or take. Madea, definitely, this is number 11. He says it's the last one, but never say never, because, you know, I have a feeling that character could pop up in any number of places, any number of ways. But if he stays true to his word, it'll be the 11th and last one. And it's admittedly, when I say shameless here, I mean, this is populist cinema. The critics look askance or appalled or whatever. And I always say with a film like Madea Family Funeral, or any of the, I've seen all the Madea films, you need to see them with an audience.
Yes.
They truly, if you're sitting by yourself in your living room, and particularly if you're a real snob like I am, you're going to sit there stone-faced through a lot of it. But if you're in a crowded movie theater, when other people start laughing, how can you not go along? And a lot of it is funny, but, you know, it's just kind of like, you know, obvious funny.
It's a shared experience, though.
And you know what? In terms of that shared experience, it's a reminder that Tyler Perry, you know, begins in the theater, really, and he's barnstorming with plays that were outside of the cultural mainstream, meaning the white mainstream. And the reason I say that is, like in Baltimore, for instance, when his plays would come into the Lyric Theater, there was very little advertising, like in daily newspapers or TV stations or whatever. More often, the advertising would be flyers in a beauty parlor. More often, it would be people at church talking about it. It really was word of mouth. It was that kind of networking at ground level. And when you went to see the plays themselves, there was a lot of that kind of call and response. It was the audience directly mm-hmm. interacting. It's no different in the movie theater. When I went to see this Madea film or any of the others, you know, the characters are pitching it right out at you, mm-hmm. and people in the audience are responding back, and it's a different dynamic there. So you know, these can be enjoyable films, but it helps to have a crowd there with you.
There's always at least one person in the theater who will laugh so hard they snort.
I heard a lot of snorting when I went to see this, which, you know, the Miss Manners in me thought, please don't snort. it brings that out. Why don't we talk about the appeal of that character?
Of Madea?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I just want to say one quick thing about Tyler Perry before I forget, since we were talking about the movie Vice. He was terrific as Colin Powell.
Well, see, that's one reason why. And I'm doing armchair psychoanalysis here. One reason why I think he's announcing that Madea Family Funeral is the 11th and last there, because he does that. Not only does he do that character, he does multiple characters
right.
within the film, and it's his shtick, and it works, and he could always keep doing more. It would always work. But when you see him in other roles, it's sort of a RuPaul phenomenon. When you see him do other things, you realize, you know, he really can. He doesn't have to put on the dress. He doesn't have to do things like that. And I think, again, it's an actor looking to stretch. You know, at this point, he's made a lot of money, and he can make money with almost anything he does. So I don't think he wants to be, you know, chained to that particular character. Much as he obviously enjoys doing it, I think as an actor, he's far enough along. And you know, he's also his own writer and producer and everything else, director. So he'll do what he wants. And, yeah, I expect he'll do films in which they might not all be straight roles or, you know, dramatic roles there, but at least to do something different.
Did you see Acrimony, which was, I believe, his last movie?
I did,
movie.
Of course. Yeah, I wouldn't have missed it.
What did you think?
Well, I'm not, you know, the films themselves are slapdash, and I've always said that he hasn't learned anything in terms of the craft of filmmaking. I'm trying to say that without sounding really mean, but when you watch the films, most scenes just go on too long. The pacing is really uneven. The comic material, there's some really funny stuff there, but there's other stuff that's just like low humor, just kind of mm-hmm. like vulgar and not all that funny particularly, but it's just there and keeps clubbing you. And the films have this kind of stop and go But where you know where it actually is fascinating in A Madea Family Funeral, there's one scene that goes on much too long, and yet I find it fascinating for that very reason. Madea and a few of the other characters are in a car. They get pulled over by the police.
Yes. It's a very funny scene.
Well, funny and not funny because, yes. You know, when you think about all the police pullovers and driving while black phenomenon and all that, but yes, there are a lot of laugh lines in it, but the fact that it just goes on, them sitting in the car wondering what the cop is going to do, you know, frankly, like almost any editor would say cut, 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 mm-hmm. but the fact that it holds on that actually took this really silly film and in moments in that scene it became like ultra serious. Mm-hmm. Like, are they going to be busted or like, you know, actually beat up or something? And it's really like borderline scary in a film that otherwise is so silly, you wouldn't say you're scared.
Or you think, are we actually going to see Madea take on, you know, a white cop trying to do an illegal...
And if she did, you know she would get the better of it.
Yes.
What has been referred to as her weaponized purse?
Yes, the weaponized purse.
She would, but the films themselves have got that kind of really uneven, helter-skelter mix of low humor and high melodrama that they really bounce around. Some things hit and some miss. And my feeling is, you know, think about it as a batting average. That, you know, that enough of it hits, enough registers that it works. And her character has such a devoted following that people will stick through her through some scenes that really are kind of draggy. Not just in the obvious sense of dressing up, but draggy otherwise in terms of the pacing.
Yes, and I think the reason that character has such appeal is it's in a way, you know, the way you'd like to be able to get away with being. You know, she's very cynical. She always has a great comeback line, but she's got heart. I mean, she's warm. But, you know, she will haul off and hit somebody with a purse. And haven't we all wanted to do that?
Next time I'm carrying a purse, I'll think about it. But to your point there, in terms of that character, I went and I looked at A.O. Scott's review of this film in the New York Times, and I'll just quote briefly what he said about Madea in terms of her appeal. The point of Madea, of course, is that she observes no boundaries, even as she upholds traditional moral sensibilities. By the end, she has served as funeral director, minister, and marriage counselor, mocking the authority of such professions while also underlining their necessity. Her absolute silliness is the condition of her wisdom, and maybe vice versa. She helps the other family members heal and move on from their self-inflicted hurts, asking for nothing in return but attention. It's a pretty good bargain, all in all.
And when you think about her with her, you know, coterie of other older ladies, she's the wise one. Although I do like how all of them figure out what's going on, you know, with the younger folks, like immediately.
Yeah,
fooled.
Yeah, without spoiling the story, it's actually a very rich story, at least a very busy story.
Yes.
Because there's a lot of adultery, a lot of people fooling around, and it's all within the family and next of kin
kind of
thing.
Right, it's almost a French farce with the door opens here.
Well, it really is. Like if somebody's misbehaving in a hotel room, mm-hmm. guess who's in the next hotel
yes.
room also fooling around? And then it goes from there. So it's a full roster of characters that way. And one of the really smart moves on Tyler Perry's part is that some of it is like borderline risque, vulgar, or just, you know, against moral codes, however you want to put it. But the films always remain PG-13, and he knows just where to hold the line or somehow draw the line there. So you can kind of laugh in a down and dirty way, but it really actually is relatively clean. So I don't know if I'd recommend it for every family member, but you know what I'm getting at is that it's really pitched at the widest audience possible, because it really would be easy to drop in some, you know, four-letter words or a situation that really goes a little too far. And Perry, he knows exactly in terms of the Motion Picture Academy and the rating system exactly how far you can push with that. And one reason he pulls back is that Madea, for all of her misbehaviors and her criminal record, right?
Yes,
come on, we can't ignore
that.
Which is extensive. We could fill our half-hour show with the criminal record. For all of that, there is essentially a sense of integrity.
Yes,
and that she knows what's right and wrong and so on. And
even when she goes thug.
And she does go thug there. You know, it's so funny just actually looking at the titles of some of the films there. You know, I Can Do Bad All By Myself, and you know, and all these Madea's Witness Protection. you know, and in fact, you know, a film called Temptation, and you know, and just on and on with all of the ways in which she misbehaves, and yet oftentimes, and in terms of bringing the family together, it's one reason why so many of her films, they might be themed or timed to, you know, where she goes to jail or this or that, but also they're oftentimes pegged to holidays. And that's, mm-hmm. again, in a crassly commercial way, she Madea Halloween and its sequel, she's done two of those with Halloween. There's also a Madea Christmas. There are all sorts. So it's not just Madea Goes to Jail. It's also Madea Goes to Christmas.
And, yes.
And again, in a very crassly commercial way, obviously you release the film at that time of year and you cash in on that. But also within the storyline, the fact that a family gets together for Christmas, and of course they argue and do all kinds of bad stuff. But then there's going to be a reconciliation. There's going to be that happy ending there. Yeah.
And you have like an endless thing that you can do on Saturday Night Live, you know. Madea goes to book club. You know, Madea goes to the beach. You know, you can see. Now, how did you think this stacked up with the other Madea movies?
I actually thought that you know, he's been cycling and recycling for a long time now. I feel like in terms of a lot of the characters, he's done about as much as he can with them. And that's one reason why I did find it kind of draggy in places. So there were some parts that made me laugh, but other parts where I was kind of marking time. So I think, you know, he could keep cranking out more. There's still other holidays that haven't been
pursued
yet. Right,
exploited.
Yeah,
Madea,
yeah.
Thanksgiving.
Well,
Madea Valentine's
Day. Be careful what you say out loud.
Flag
there.
Day.
Be careful what you say, because it'll be in theaters next year. But
Arbor Day.
Arbor Day, yeah. But all those things could happen. But it just seems to me that he's ready to move on to other things. And a reminder, too, that he did a few films that are non-Madea ones. So we'll see where that goes for him. But that's why I think the character, you know, to say that character's met his or her demise, it's almost like saying a superhero character, you know, was blown up or something. Well, you know what happens. In the sequel, you find out, oh, no, you thought she was blown up.
She was just, you know, collected in the antimatter device.
Well, yeah, I was just about to say that. I mean, you know that, don't you?
Of course.
It was the antimatter device. So you can always, and Madea's storylines are so flimsy, you could always find an excuse there. Because I think it's significant that when you listen to the title of this film, A Madea Family Funeral, and you hear it's the last film in the series, you might initially mistakenly think, oh, she dies. But no, of course not. It's a family patriarch who dies, and she's there to officiate as minister. Speaking of which, the scene where she's like a minister and making this long speech, that goes on so long. It just...
Yeah, and it is speechy.
It's very speechy. It's not particularly funny. In terms of the moral of it, whatever, you get it pretty quickly. And that's a case where it's not always an unalloyed blessing to be your own producer, director, writer, because anyone working on a scene like that would say, you know, I think maybe we can cut here. You don't need to make the speech go on this way. But there's no restraint there. It just keeps going. But at that point, the audience is so much with her as a character. And there is some funny business involving the coffin itself.
And
without spoiling that, but some rather rude things
the
that happened.
Scenes never church. Imagined in Six Feet Under, the TV program.
Well, that show can go pretty far at times, too. Maybe not in the particular way Madea would. Yeah, there'd be some cross-fertilization.
Yeah. Yeah, they could get something happening there.
But see, that's one virtue for Tyler Perry, is just that because he's created all these films and all these characters, and also has done some more serious work, I think things are looking good for him in that respect. You know, this Madea film, you know, the week Captain Marvel, you know, opened and had spectacular box office, the number two film was Madea Family Funeral. Admittedly, well back in the pack, but you know, Tyler Perry's films are inexpensive to make and market. And you know what? He doesn't rely on that whole network of critics and blah 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 marketing. His films are almost never previewed for the critics. The New York Times review will appear the day after the film opens, because he doesn't even preview it for the Times.
Yeah,
that
he has
something.
A built-in audience, I think. I saw them both on the same day, and Captain Marvel was packed, and the Madea movie still had pretty decent.
Considering how quickly films run through now.
And it had been out for a little while.
If it's been out a few weeks, that, you know, it's pretty much had its audience at that point.
Well, that takes us to the end of our segment here on At the Movies with Mike and Marie. So stay tuned next time when we'll discuss two other movies.
I look forward to it.
And look for your upcoming class in the fall in a brand new class.
I'm doing a brand new speaking of Tyler Perry, I don't think he'll make my syllabus, but we'll talk about him. I'm doing a brand new course on images of African Americans in cinema, and it ranges from mainstream Hollywood movies to independent films. So, you know, some really negative stereotypes, frankly, but also more affirmative, more positive images, a real mix of how that representation has been handled on screen. So certainly Tyler Perry will factor into the discussion. Maybe I should use one of his films. Which one to pick, though, out of all these?
You know, you might just have to do clips from all of them.
Oh, my goodness. I'll have to spread the course out over a full
year.
The
best parts. Thanks for joining us this week on At the Movies with Mike and Marie. We'll see you next time.
See you then.
Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.